Housing for the Aged Action Group, HAG for short, a housing group for older people run by older people. Present
Raise the Roof!
We advocate for secure, affordable and appropriate housing. So listen up on the second and fourth Wednesday of the month at 5:30pm on 3CR 855 on your AM dial.
Oh, that's right. You're listening to Raise the Roof, the Housing for the Aged Action Group show here on 3CR 855 AM. Listeners, I hope you're not getting that same distortion through your speakers that I'm getting through my headphones, but I think that's not you. That's just me. My name's Shane. I'm here in the studio with Liz. How are you doing today, Liz?
Yeah, I'm not too bad, Shane. Actually, I'm a bit cranky this week about ever-increasing rents and real estate agents trying to evict people for no good reason. So, yeah, I'm grumpy.
Well,
honestly, I think that's justified, though. Justified grump.
Justified grump. That could be the theme for our show, really.
Yeah.
So we will come back to talk about some justified grump a little bit later. But first up today, we're going to hear from David Kelly, who is a housing researcher at the Centre for Urban Research at RMIT. They have a forum coming up. HAG is going to be speaking at it. I assume that means Fiona's speaking at it.
I presume so.
So we recorded an interview with David earlier this week, and I'm going to play it for you now. So thanks so much for talking to us today. Maybe to start, could you tell our listeners a bit about the sort of research that you do and what is a housing researcher?
Yes. Well, thanks for having me. So, yes, I'm a housing researcher at RMIT, and what that looks like is over the last 4 to 5 years, I've been pretty constantly concentrating on this idea of housing crisis that's emerged within kind of public discourse and conversations, and asking questions about who benefits from such a declaration of housing crisis, who loses, and the sorts of material things that are happening on the ground as a result of that declaration of housing crisis. So along with some colleagues here at RMIT, Libby Porter and Priya Kunjan, we've been working for the last 3 years on a big project, which is looking at multiple sites of housing crisis. So one key site has been the homelessness service sector in Melbourne, looking at the experiences of crisis accommodation and the crisis resource system in general, and from the perspective of those who have lived experience going through the system. So we did a big study over the last 3 years, of which this was a major component of the homelessness service system. But then what happened over that three-year period was in 2023, the state government announced that they were going to demolish all the 44 public housing towers. So our research was already concentrating on public housing as well as a site of housing crisis, but then became far more involved in the context of this controversy. So those are two aspects of the project, homelessness and public housing. But then the other major aspect of the project is the land question, and particularly First Nations sovereignty and how that factors into how housing crisis has unfolded in this place over the course of hundreds of years, but how we see the through lines of those conditions set down very early in the colony coming through today and impacting how we treat and how we manage different forms of precarity, what we're calling dwelling precarity.
Yeah, well, sorry. One of the things that I wanted to ask you about was the forum that's coming up, or the event that's coming up, is called From Housing Crisis to Dwelling Justice. And I was curious about that phrase, dwelling justice. So at HAG, we often talk about housing justice. And I guess I was curious about the distinction that you're making there and what's the difference between thinking about things in terms of housing justice versus dwelling justice.
Yeah. So like when people say housing, I think one of the things that often comes to mind is the actual dwelling structure itself. So the shelter, the four walls, the doors, the windows, the beds, all of those things is very physical meaning baked into housing. And so what we were very attuned to in our research and What people who were involved in our research were very attuned to was the fact that housing crisis in and of itself isn't a crisis of the dwelling or the building or the built form in any way, shape, or form, but rather is a crisis that they experience because of a whole bunch of other decisions made elsewhere in the system. So, for instance, it's related the fact that we've had an increase in funding for prisons over the last 10, 20, 30 years and a decrease in funding for public housing over the same period. And so what we were trying to do by calling it dwelling rather than housing was expand the view of what produces housing crisis or context for housing crisis. So it was really trying to break away from this very narrow frame of thinking about housing to ask more questions, bigger questions about land, about homelessness and poverty management, but generally really getting to the heart of the fact of Indigenous dispossession being the first act of housing crisis in this place.
I think that's really interesting. I mean, often a lot of discussion about housing crisis is focused on the idea of increasing supply as the solution to the housing crisis, and I guess framing it in that broader way suggests that there are the other or more useful or potentially more productive ways of thinking about it.
Yeah, and I think that that is part of the kind of capitalization of the housing crisis being declared, is that developers, policymakers, people who can see value in getting involved and intervening, really capitalizing on this housing crisis terminology. And what we're trying to do is say, that's all supply agenda stuff. That's all very baked in assumptions about housing and value extraction and rent extraction. That's basically baked into how capitalism works. So what we're trying to do is say, the supply agenda is not the problem here. What we can observe in data over a decade is that there are more houses per person now than there were at any other point in time in history in Australia. So there is more houses available than there are people who need them, and we have a high vacancy rate in this country as well, 1 in 10. So it's fundamentally not a supply issue. There is enough houses, and it's a matter of access, really, rather than supply. So we really just completely disavow and write off the supply argument because it's not based in fact, and all of the academic research that's been produced today, particularly in urban planning, says that the supply agenda is not what's causing the housing crisis, it's access.
Absolutely. And thank you so much for raising that, David. I think that's really important that we talk about things in that way, because there's the growth mindset that just says, oh, look, just build more houses. It's not actually going to solve the problems if some of the fundamentals preventing access are not addressed. Now, I understand that you have a forum coming up on the 26th. Is that right? Do you want to tell us about that?
Yeah, that's right. So we have a public event called From Housing Crisis to Dwelling Justice, and it's on Wednesday, the 26th of November, from 5:30 p.m. to 8 p.m., so after work. And we really are wanting, you know, people who are not academics, people who are not researchers, people who feel like there may be a step away from the issues that we're talking about, to really come to the event and take that step into the discourse and to understand the different conversations that have been had in what we're kind of terming the dwelling justice movement, which involves First Nations advocates, academics, activists, and as well as public housing tenants and Housing for the Age Action Group are participating in a panel discussion. And we're also screening a film documentary. So this is really platforming the lived experience of those who have gone through public housing relocations and renewal processes over recent years, which then speaks directly to the current renewal and demolition program that we're seeing rolled out across every public housing estate in the city. So really what we're asking, or what we're doing with this event, is asking people to come along and and engage with the kind of urban politics of the day. So this is the biggest political issue in the city at the minute that affects over 10,000 low-income residents. And so we're really, what we're asking is for them to think about this not as just one technical issue over public housing estates or public housing buildings, but rather an issue that affects the entire city, that this is an issue of urban politics and needs to be engaged on those terms.
That sounds great. We'll get you to give out some contact information, or we'll give it out later in the show for people who might want to come along and find out some more about that event.
Great.
I am interested to hear, like you mentioned, that one of the focuses of your research is the homelessness service sector. HAG is part of that sector. So, I mean, I'm not sure at what level of sort of, you know, where that research is at, but I'm interested in what some of the sort of findings or ideas that are coming out of that research might be.
Yeah, so we were conducting research in the homelessness sector alongside workers and alongside clients of the sector at a time when the COVID funding was running out, for the want of a better word. So during the time we had, for the first year post-COVID, we had a lot of resources still in the sector, a lot of capacity for the sector to engage accommodation providers and provide shelter for those who needed it most. What happened during the time of the fieldwork was that money was removed and clawed back by the state, and what we had was just a mass turn away protocol enacted by access points around the city. And so there were less and less resources getting to those people who needed them, and then for those who were actually engaging with the sector throughout COVID because of the amount of resources that were available, those people were then disengaged after resources were pulled. So we've seen a massive disengagement of the client base from the service system because the service system doesn't have the capacity to meet the needs of that cohort. So that was one of the most concerning contexts surrounding the research. But another thing was this conditional use of resources. So only certain people were getting certain resources, and there was a kind of there's a well-known triage system within the sector that basically produced a hierarchy of need. And whilst everyone who attends a homelessness access point is in some type of need, in some critical housing need, most of those people were turned away, and to those who were actually granted resources, hit a very narrow eligibility criteria, what we're kind of thinking of as like a Goldilocks zone for support. So a lot of people, singles on JobSeeker in particular, were just turned away without any questions, given a A4 piece of paper with a rooming house list full of telephone numbers and told to, conduct some self-help. And so there was just this a mass kind of refusal to meet the needs of the client base. And in doing so, it produced a lot of anxiety and fear within the sector.
Yep.
And I'm not sure I really got to the answer that.
No, I think you did. Yeah, no, thinking about that in terms of the ways that services, the constraints that services have in the different types of people that present at services. And so that is very interesting, I think, for services to take on board and to be aware of that is the findings of the research, because I think there's something there that means services need to kind of reflect and potentially advocate up the chain further, so that singles on JobSeeker have got more access to the supports if it seems too difficult for the services to be supporting those people. I mean, I think one of the things that is just so striking is that rents are so expensive that a single person on JobSeeker, so many places are just really out of reach. So then what that means for the services is a systemic kind of real barrier there. But I think it's really useful for their services to have that finding, to know about that from your research.
Yeah, and I think another thing to answer there is housing. There was no exit points from the homelessness service sector. There's nowhere to exit someone from a particular service program into housing because there is no housing. All of the housing was either too expensive, non-existent off the market, and between public and community housing, there were just no options. And I think what we were observing was, because of the lack of supply in public housing over the years, people who were immediately eligible for public housing and were put onto the Victorian Housing Register as a condition of receiving support, then had nowhere to go. Like, they couldn't go to public housing, so it became this aspirational space that could never really be attained.
I mean, it's interesting also to think about it in terms of like resourcing, in that the, you know, as you say, coming out of COVID, the city of Melbourne, there was a lot of resourcing in the homeless sector in terms of accommodating people, at least temporarily. And now the city of Melbourne, once again, is putting resources, you know, there's resources in the city of Melbourne for homelessness, but it's in the form of, you know, wages for contract security guards to move people on.
Yeah. And I think that these things are related. I think that we're seeing a kind of a response across the city, across now up to 5 LGAs that are adopting this Melbourne model of managing their visible street homelessness. And that is in direct response to a structural problem that is not enough housing access for people who need it. So it's no wonder that councils would revert to such tactics, considering that even if support were granted, there are no options for exits into secure, stable accommodation. So I think this is a sign that local governments at least have lost faith in maybe state and federal governments' ability to address the conditions of housing crisis, and are therefore engaging in these nefarious tactics in order to manage what they see as visible homelessness.
Right. So if people want to hear more about this or talk more about it, they can come along on the 26th to the From Housing Crisis to Dwelling Justice Forum. Do people need to register, get tickets, or what should they do if they want to come along?
Yes, tickets are free. So on humanitix.com, so if you go to humanitix.com/crisis-to-justice, then they can register there for a free ticket and come along.
All right. Well, thanks very much for your time today.
Thanks, Shane. Thanks, Liz.
Thanks, David.
Bye. We're going to hear a couple of community service announcements, and then we'll be back for Liz to tell us about why, to tell us about people getting evicted for no reason and why it sucks, etc. We'll be right back.
But I won't be sworn at and I won't be bossed around. That includes them, the big bosses. They won't be bossing me around either. I will find a way.
Rents are through the roof. The cost of living is skyrocketing, and public housing is under attack. How do we fight back? Join us on Wednesday, the 26th of November from 6 p.m. at RMIT University's City Campus for From Housing Crisis to Dwelling Justice, a free public event that gets to the heart of the housing struggle. Featuring the premiere of Bay Views for All, a documentary about the fight to save the Barrack Beacon public housing estate, and a panel discussion with public housing residents, activists, and experts, this is one you won't want to miss. Register for a free ticket at events.humanitix.com/crisis-to-justice.
It's never occurred to them they've actually got something valuable here.
A 3CR supporter.
Has Centrelink made a decision you disagree with? Most Centrelink decisions can be appealed up to 3 times. Examples of decisions you can appeal include whether you're eligible for a payment, cancellation or suspension of your payment, how much you get paid, and Centrelink debts. One of the most common Centrelink decisions appealed are Centrelink debts. Centrelink will say you owe a debt if the staff determine you've been paid more than you should have. debts can occur for a variety of reasons. In some instances, if there's been an administrative error or if you have special circumstances, you may not have to repay that debt. The appeal process is free, but time limits can apply and will affect your entitlement to back payment. Social Security Rights Victoria is a specialist community legal centre providing Victorians free advice to help you understand your Centrelink issues and the appeal processes. You can contact Social Security Rights Victoria on 9481 0355 or online at ssrv.org.au. The Federation of Community Legal Centres is a 3CR supporter.
You're listening to Raise the Roof, the Housing for the Aged Action Group show on 3CR, 8:55 a.m. With Shane and Liz. And Liz, there's something that you want to talk about, so take it away.
Yeah, thanks, Shane. I wanted to have a bit of a rant about some upcoming changes to the Residential Tenancies Act. So this month in Victoria, change will be implemented that means that landlords will no longer be able to give notices to vacate for no reason for the end of a fixed term lease if that is the first 12-month lease. So one of the problems with this, though, is that this abolition of no reason notices to vacate only applies to renters in residential fixed term leases, and it doesn't apply to residents living in rooming houses or caravan parks. And we know that people living in rooming houses and caravan parks are some of the most vulnerable people. So just to give a little bit of context, so in the Residential Tenancies Act, landlords can give notices to vacate for a whole bunch of different reasons, but there's all these rules around it, and it is can be quite difficult for a landlord to evict a renter because of the level of detail that they need to go to in order to do this. So the notices to vacate that were for the end of a fixed term lease for no reason, it basically meant that landlords could evict tenants for, they didn't have to go to the same level of effort to kind of prove that there was an issue and that the landlord needed the property back. So for example, and we've had clients before who had received these notices to vacate for things like a smell, or they were in rent arrears, but it was never really that bad. Like they'd get a few days in arrears and it was more of an annoyance than it was really a good reason to terminate the fact that they had a roof over their head. So it's a good thing that the state government is abolishing these notices to vacate, because people having a roof over their head is so fundamentally important. But the fact that caravan park operators and rooming house residents will still be able to serve these notices to vacate for no reason, it doesn't do much really for the most vulnerable people. And I think one of the things that's really problematic is that the state government is saying, and their press releases are saying, that this is to enhance fairness for renters and to enhance renters' rights, but actually it's the most vulnerable people who there won't really be a change for them.
So I have some ranting to go along with this,
if
I can add to what you're saying. So first of all, the thing that drives me the craziest about this is that the government and lots of housing advocacy organisations talk about this as banning no-fault evictions.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, there are many ways that a tenant can be evicted where there's no fault. Not that we would accept the framing, you know, that renters are at fault if they couldn't afford the rent or something. But there's all kinds of notices to vacate that just have nothing to do with the tenant's conduct, that the landlord wants to renovate, sell, move in, etc. Those are all no-fault evictions.
Mm-hmm.
But the government just got in love with the phrase, we're getting rid of no-fault evictions, which they had no intention of doing and haven't done in the slightest. What they got rid of, as you say, for a particular kind of tenure is a no-reason notice. And it's particularly galling to me that, as you say, caravan parks can still use these kinds of notices, because actually the caravan park version is worse than the renter's version, because the renter's version of an end of fixed term notice to vacate can only be given during your first fixed term at the property. So the first 12 months or whatever the period is that you're living in your home, at the end of that first 12 months, they can give you this no reason notice until the changes. But once you're into your second, third, fourth, fifth, tenth, whatever fixed term, they could no longer give that notice. So the premise was that you were sort of getting this trial period that they could kick you out at the end of if it hadn't worked. But then if you're allowed to stay, obviously you're okay as a tenant, so you can stay. But if you're in a caravan park, they can give you the notice to vacate for your fifth, sixth, tenth no fixed term. They can just evict people for no reason at essentially any point, no matter how long they've been living in the park. So it's kind of an absurd situation that your security of tenure in a caravan park can be better if you don't have a fixed term than if you do. So that's really my rants, my little collection of rants around no reason notices and end of fixed terms.
Yeah. And I mean, it takes a really, really long time for there to be legislative change. And I think, you know, the government, it's not like it's an accidental oversight. It's not like we could just ring them up and say, excuse me, could you please just change the wording to include rooming house residents and caravan park residents? Like, they've thought about this. And that's the really troubling thing about it, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the positive way to look at this is that the government, you know, recognises the significance of rental accommodation and that there needs to be some changes for renters. But the unfortunately, that means that they can exclude or fail to consider or prioritise the interests of renters and not think about how that impacts other kinds of people in different kinds of housing. We're almost out of time, and I really want, before we go, to mention that this week the Victorian government gave out its Social Housing Volunteer Awards. These are annual awards, the one of which is named after Molly Hadfield, who's an early and very influential member of HAG. You still hear her voice in the intro to our show every fortnight. So happy to say that this year's Molly Hadfield Award winner was Noel Cryan. We'll try and get him on the show sometime to talk about it. What it says here is Noel has been a pillar of his elderly persons unit complex since 2006, welcoming new residents and offering support with warmth and kindness. From building a community garden and helping with handyman tasks to driving neighbours to shops and providing a listening ear, he's always there for others. Generous and humble, Noel has created a community of friendship, respect and harmony, making him truly one in a million. That's nice. And the other social housing award is the Francis Pennington Award. And this year that went to the North Melbourne Public Housing Residents Association. Sorry, I'm going to have to talk faster because we're running out of time. Which is great because the North Housing, some of those people have been really active in fighting the government in terms of the public housing tower demolition. Great that they got an award for it. But recognise their volunteer-led group that champions the rights and well-being of public housing residents. Maybe we'll try and get them in sometime as well.
Yeah, awesome. Thanks, Shane.
So before we go, just to give out some contact information, if you want to give us a call because you're an older Victorian with a housing issue and you want to get some advice or assistance, the best number to call is 1300 765 178. That's 1300 765 178. Or if you want to get involved in some of our campaigning work, join one of our working groups or something like that, you can give us a call on 9654 7389. That's 9654 7389. We are going to leave you with a song, and Liz, I might leave it to you to introduce this one.
Oh, yes. So this is by a band called The Apartments, and the song is called That's What the Music Is For.
That's What the Music Is For. Thanks for listening. We'll be back in a couple of weeks. Bye.